Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting and buy the hit new series Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD. Veronica is a smart and fearless 18-year-old private investigator apprentice dedicated to solving tough mysteries in the seaside town of Neptune. Discover Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Coming up on this Friday bonus edition of Film Spotting, comedies old and new, the penultimate film in our six-week screwball comedies marathon, The Lady Eve, and Accepted, a new comedy starring Justin Long.
Plus, listener feedback and music by Paul Birch. But first, it is time for our second Preston Sturges film in a row, Barbara Stanwyck and Henry Fonda in The Lady Eve.
Are you always going to be interested in snakes?
Well, snakes are my life, in a way.
What a life.
I suppose it does sound sort of silly. I mean, I suppose I should have married, settled down. I imagine my father always wanted me to. As a matter of fact, he's told me so rather plainly. I just never cared for the brewing business.
On a cruise ship from Central America to New York, con artist Gene Harrington, played by Barbara Stanwyck, sets her sights on millionaire brewer's son and snake expert Charles Pike, played by Henry Fonda. But instead of conning him, she falls in love with him, and he falls in love with her. And that's just in the first act of Preston Sturges' film. Adam, last week we discussed Sturges' Sullivan's Travels. His The Lady Eve came out the very same year, 1941. We both loved Sullivan's Travels. In fact, you named it your favorite of the marathon so far. But maybe even a better comparison is with a film from earlier in the marathon that neither of us liked, and I don't know why I keep bringing this up, honestly, but bringing up Baby. Both films are essentially about a woman getting her man. What did you think of The Lady Eve?
Well, you're right. That is an interesting kind of twist on how Hollywood films usually work, where they are about the woman pursuing the man. If this was a film about Henry Fonda's character pursuing her, I mean, you'd be in trouble because he doesn't even notice women, really. It's her. Right. She has to trip him to kind of knock him, you know, from his senses and recognize that there are beautiful women that are in love with him. Otherwise, he just doesn't care because he is a snake expert.
Unbelievable.
And if you've been a regular listener of the show, we've commented on the coincidences, these crazy coincidences between our marathons corresponding with whatever we're discussing. In the same week we talk about snakes on a plane, we get a screwball comedy about
a guy
who's a snake
expert.
And it's snakes on a boat. Snakes on a ship. Snakes on a boat. You know, a snake gets loose. She's afraid of him. You know, there's snakes running around his mansion. I mean, how does that happen?
Henry Fonda is reading a book titled, Do We Need Snakes? I mean, it's just, it's a commentary on our current environment.
It's insane.
Unbelievable.
It really
uncanny.
Is insane.
I'm remembering one. It was like a West Side Story, and
I can't remember
I
what
wish
the
I could remember,
was.
But there have been incredible coincidences.
Really, it has
this
been kind of nuts.
This is...
So anyway, a direct correlation here, and we had to point it out. But this is interesting, too, because unlike Bringing Up Baby, and what this has better than that film, is that as much as I love as actors Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, we talked about how just big it was. It's just, you know, again, I think I called it like a pep band or a marching band just going at full force
in your living
whole time.
Room.
In your living room, just, you know, blowing at you. And
blaring,
I couldn't take it. And here you've got the exact opposite. You really can't get more underplayed than Barbara Stanwyck and Henry Fonda. These two both are people who just go for the bare minimum all the time. I mean, Barbara Stanwyck is bigger than Henry Fonda, obviously, who's got to be one of the most stoic actors of all time. But she's still, even when she's big, so to speak, she's still subtle about it. And she's more sensual and kind of conniving in a way, but she's not big ever, you know, big dramatic.
And maybe the big thing is that at no point did I want to be Cary Grant, but in almost every point
you want
of
to be
The
Henry,
Lady Eve, you wouldn't mind being Henry Fonda.
No, you make a great comment there. And I have to say that at least early on in this, once again, I was sort of having the same experience we've had with some of these films here in the marathon where I wasn't wowed by it. You know, it's another case where the humor comes out of these ridiculous concocted situations and also physical humor. Henry Fonda tripping over things and falling into things. And I just don't really enjoy that. I don't laugh a lot at that kind of physical humor, especially when you see it coming a mile away. There's a shot later in the film where you know you're just waiting for the entire plate of food
roast beef
to fall onto
yeah.
him, and then it does, and so then it's not funny because you see that it's going to happen. And right. and so things like that don't really work for me. But then the difference, though, is that you've got a guy like Henry Fonda, who we talked about in My Darling Clementine, right. and I'm not even going to repeat
Wider,
what you
yeah.
said about it.
What did I say?
I think if I recall, you actually mentioned that you thought maybe there were times where he didn't know his lines.
Oh, that's right.
Maybe one of your most
that's right. That's the
stupid comments ever.
Where I was like, well, he was hesitating
a lot.
He was
hesitating a lot.
And, you know, the impression is that's a choice uh-huh. of his, but instead I was thinking maybe he's forgotten his
that's
lines.
That's what you said. Yes, that's actually what you said. But you know what? I made the argument. I went psychology, pop psychology, and said maybe, you know, what we know about Henry Fonda, this guy really wasn't capable of a lot of emotions. And you watch
right.
My Darling Clementine, and you see that. It's like a guy who's yeah. not willing to make himself look foolish or look right. bad or emote.
Wait a minute.
yeah. You watch The Lady Eve, the whole movie's about making himself look bad. So
yeah.
there's a certain thrill just in watching
oh,
that.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe we should mention here, Dylan Kitt, back on our, you know, 100th episode, talking about our favorite performances. Barbara Stanwyck was on Dylan Kidd's list of top comedic performances,
yeah.
Female comedic performances, and particularly mentioned the seduction scene when really, and I think he very briefly described it as just like, you know, the seduction scene from Lady Eve, where they're on the boat together. And I'm imagining some sort of canoe or something. I had
right.
no idea what he was referring to. I mean, they're on a cruise ship. Henry Fonda is in her room,
yeah.
in her suite. He's on the floor. She's in a chair. She's got her hands, you know, riding through his hair.
Uh-huh.
He's completely out of it, completely lost in the scent of her perfume,
by her
totally
perfume.
Intoxicated. And you totally understand why.
Yeah.
Barbara Stanwyck is seducing him on screen, and it's absolutely happening before your eyes, and
right.
you're believing every single
uh-huh.
moment of it. And partly that has to do with Henry Fonda, who's wonderful at just letting himself go.
Yeah.
I mean, in Preston Sturges, whatever the environment he created, Henry Fonda is just in a complete daze.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara Stanwyck is amazing. I have to say,
yeah.
I don't know if I gave you a chance to say, it sounds like you liked this film, obviously.
I ultimately am saying, it's kind of another 3-star review.
Oh, really? Okay.
I guess I'm saying that I do recommend it, and we'll get into some of the reasons,
okay.
but I didn't love it
okay.
again.
Okay? I thought it was inspiringly
did
good.
You really?
I thought it was just amazing. I thought it was hysterical, but also, like Sullivan's Travels, you have this really beautiful structure in terms of the, in this case, it's a 3-part structure, largely 2 parts with a little third part at the end. It's just so beautiful in its construction. And yet, there's never a sense that we're just watching this inevitable construction unfold in some way, or it's just like there's not just like a cleverness to that. The most important thing in Sturges' 2 films, Sullivan's Travels and this, are the characters, which I think are incredibly rich and believable as human beings.
Yeah.
And yes, there's some slapstick and screwball elements to what happens and physically, you know, and I'm not saying necessarily that the slapstick worked, but for me, it was part of the character.
Okay.
It was, yes, you know, a lot of things fell on Henry Fonda, or he fell on a lot of things, but it was part of his ultimate psychological and spiritual humiliation,
yeah.
or at least his falling for her. And I want to say, too, an incredible, incredible scene is when, you know, we have them fall in love and then break up because he finds out she's a con artist and he thinks he's conning her, and that's that. And she comes back as, well, yes, the actress that has probably the worst British accent in the history of film, but we really
Lady
can
Eve
discount
Sidwich.
That. Lady Eve Sidwich. And she comes back to his estate, and, you know, we don't know how long it's been, but she makes him believe and the audience believe, at least me, that she is a completely different person. And she hasn't changed her look at all.
Uh-huh.
She's speaking in a bad English accent and just pretending to be somebody else. And his logic, which is fantastic, is it looks too much like her to be her.
She's too much the same. If
and
she was trying
is,
to con him,
like,
she would have been different.
Those scenes, watching those scenes, him trying to figure out if it's her or not, you believe it. You believe his confusion. Again, I was completely won over that by that. And I think all of the writing is so brilliant in that, and to make us believe that. And I just like loved the counterbalance of
mm-hmm.
that act of the movie, where they have to sort of fall in love again as different people, or at least she's a different person. And it's a wonderful commentary on love in some way.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in terms of, you know, that he's in some way he's going through the motions. And it's just not as magical as it was the first time.
No. Well, the thing where obviously we did have a little different experience, though, is because for me, when we get to that moment where she's conning him, while you're sucked into it and you're buying it,
yeah.
I'm meanwhile watching it going, God, Henry Fonda's just an idiot.
Oh, really?
That's what I'm doing. I'm looking at him thinking, what an oaf. He's such an oaf. He's so stupid and naive. How could she really be in love with him? That's what I'm thinking, unfortunately. So maybe I'm being, again, kind of too cynical about
it. No, I can see that's what I was doing. Yeah, I mean, I believe it because she tells me she is, and she's such a good actress that she makes it believable. But I agree, he's not all that charismatic or interesting, particularly the second and then the third time around,
right,
to really make us believe that she'd fall for him and not somebody else. But
yeah, I also think that, in contrast to what you said, that later in the film, we definitely get the end of the film is sped up to the point where it's like, okay, this is a screwball comedy and X, Y, and Z have to happen,
sure,
and let's have those happen. And it doesn't ever really feel that believable or like it should be happening that way. It feels kind of tidy, and I think all these screwball comedies in a way kind of have that problem. Even some of the musicals we saw, like Swing Time, kind of end with, well, we got to end on a happy note, so let's wrap this up. And that's kind of how they feel. But the reason I ended up being won over by the film is that it ends up really tying nicely at the end, the metaphor, the whole Eve metaphor and the snake metaphor. It does pay off because what you understand is, you know, this biblical metaphor of the snake representing knowledge is that you realize that this whole film really has been about repression.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these screwball comedies are sexual repression. And the knowledge, accepting the knowledge of your own sexual needs. That's really, Henry Fonda has been able to push that completely to the back of his mind. And then he bites the apple, so to speak.
Right.
He meets Barbara Stanwyck's character and he lusts after her. And he's lusting after her the entire time. You know that he just wants to take her to his room and he wants to have sex with her.
And
she doesn't let him.
Right.
But then later in the film, when you get then to the end of the film where they come back together, that's exactly
that
what they're
going to
go and
they
do.
They go to the bedroom.
And it reminded me of The End of the Awful Truth, which I loved The End of the Awful Truth for that same reason, where all of a sudden you're watching this film that's so prudish, so 1940s, you know, prudish, and no one's doing anything really that bold sexually or whatever, or vulgar, certainly. And then you get to the end, you realize, like, these people just want to get busy.
Yeah.
And that, for
I think
me,
this
is enough
movie is much more clear
fun
about that than The Awful Truth,
I think it
honestly
is.
And I loved that. I mean, it's not even innuendo. I mean, there is innuendo, but it's also how people speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and she has such control over their dialogue. I loved the way, and I feel like I didn't have to suspend my disbelief for the bulk of this movie, because the dialogue that Sturgis has written for Barbara Stanwyck absolutely carries the logic of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she has got him, and he even says it. He's like, I imagine life with you is like a roller coaster ride. And you're like, yeah. And you admit too, it's like, that would be kind of fun.
Right.
We've all met people like that just really always keep us on our toes, and yet we're still interested. We still want to know what's going on. And I mean, I finished watching this film and wanted to, you know, launch a Preston Sturges fan site.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these
we
two
should
films
definitely get into more of
released
films
in the same year.
Yeah.
I mean, really remarkably sophisticated, funny.
I definitely think Sullivan's Travels is more sophisticated, which is why I got into it more. But I will say, giving a little advance, you know, foreshadowing of our awards, as much as I like Veronica Lake and some of the other performances we've seen, I can say right now that Barbara Stanwyck's performance here is my favorite female performance.
Well, I was thinking too,
so
it's getting
far,
all of a sudden getting to be a very crowded field.
It is,
in terms
yeah
of performances here.
Okay.
All right, if you've seen The Lady Eve and want to share your thoughts, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, the final film in the Screwball Comedies Marathon, Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy in Adam's Rib.
After the break, Van Holgren? Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Are you changing your name to the Fantastics?
Carrie and I, the Fantastics.
Okay. Your thoughts on
tour all next year.
Name change and other less consequential topics, such as Oliver Stone's World Trade Center and our top five true stories. Stay with us.
My back was to the wall, I didn't know who to call, Montreal. It's a shame it was you who had to break my fall, and I tumbled like a toy, oh Montreal. By her clothes and her hair, she's a modern air, Montreal. Bet you never thought you'd see someone like her, someone like me, oh Montreal. Montreal, we had it all in our hands, and we rolled around like dice.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Sam Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that song there from Paul Birch's album. Did I call you Hallgren?
I think you might have.
Well, I'm sticking with it. Sorry. a little shout out there from Paul Birch to, I want to give a shout out anyway, to Dominique and all of our listeners in gorgeous Montreal with that song, of course, titled Montreal. I, of course, was in Montreal like 2 or 3 weeks ago for about 24 hours, right. Which is just a crime, really, to be in that city for only that long. So
the Paris of North America.
It is. Yeah. I think it could be. Okay. Yeah. Also, donors. We weren't able to thank the people who were so nice as to donate on our last show. And, of course, we have, as we said last week, we've started putting those names on our website. So if you donated, and many of you did, and we really appreciated it, you donated through one of the links on the filmspotting.net site, you will be able to find your name and your new nickname, your Van Hallgren nickname, right, on our site in the notes for this show. So go ahead and do that. But with that said,
yeah,
we had a number of people very generous, but we had some that were extremely generous,
right,
that we do want to thank members here on the show. Two Silver Club members.
That's right. Andrew, Microbus, Soulmate, and Avery, Ivory, Towering Inferno.
Oh, I like that
That's
one.
That's nice.
Okay, we also had a Gold Club donation, a very nice, very generous Gold Club donation, and I thought I would come up with this one because his name immediately sparked a movie reference for me, and so I'm giving you this nickname, Shane, and I hope you don't mind. We would like to thank Shane sitting by the dock of the Pod Bay Doors, Bowman.
Oh, well done. Well done. You're learning.
I'm learning. I'm trying. I'm learning from the master. So right. Again, thank you to everyone who donated. We really do appreciate the support. Also wanted to mention something we mentioned in the dope sheet that went out earlier in the week, and that is I had an amazing opportunity over the weekend, last weekend, to appear on BBC Radio.
BBC 5?
BBC 5, Radio 5 Live on their weekend breakfast program.
Amazing.
I guess they wanted to talk to some lame American movie critics about Snakes on a Plane, and somehow our names got pulled up, and we did talk about it. I ended up kind of winning the coin toss and got to go on the air, and it's only 4 minutes long, and it's not incredibly deep or profound or anything, but if you do want to listen, I'll post a link to the audio.
And you showed an amazing amount of restraint given your eventual review of the
That's
film.
True. Well, of course, my view of it changed as the weekend went on, and so it evolved a little bit, but you realize
that the movie actually has deep resentment and hatred for anybody that might go.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, right. But no. So anyway, we had a good time. I had a good time appearing, and I doubt the BBC's listening, but thanks for putting us on.
Yeah,
it was
amazing.
It's pretty ridiculous. I don't know that I've ever actually been that nervous as I was when, at 12 a.m. I was going to be live, in front of 2 million people.
Unbelievable.
So that was pretty insane. I hope I acquitted myself okay there. And we also have a correction. This time it's a correction of mine, though.
Amazing.
It should be fun to point out, Sam. We should go ahead and point this out. This is our Friday bonus show. We're laid back.
Sure.
We're going to just have some fun with this show.
Right.
Recently, I think you had Elephant in your top five true stories, and you Gus Van Sant. Correctly.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago, we get an email from someone who's works for a big agency. I'm not going to say which one, but a big agency, talent agency in Hollywood.
Right.
And this person was so annoyed that Sam Kemp
Gus
kept calling Gus Van Sant, and that she actually contacted Van Zant's agent to verify the pronunciation of his name.
There's a file, Hallgren.
Uh-huh.
Van Hallgren Sam. Or
exactly.
Whatever.
And now you've learned your lesson.
Yeah, I certainly have.
Okay,
that's all you need to do to correct me is, humiliate me in front of...
Do it. That's funny. Anyway, so we also had a correction, though. This time it's me, and it's not a mispronunciation, but I got to thank Kent Shelton in Denver, Colorado, for pointing this out. The second I saw his email pop up, I went, oh my God, I know what he's writing about. And who can forget, I talked about one of my top five true stories, In Cold Blood, the famous scene where the main character is sitting in front of the window with the brilliant cinematography.
Yes.
It looks like he's crying and he's reciting the words, "Tiger, tiger, burning bright." Because, of course, he's William Blake, not Robert Blake.
Ouch.
Ouch.
Yeah.
That that apparently was the English major in me coming through, and I referred to him as Robert Blake.
Props to William Blake.
Yeah,
though,
exactly.
It's
so anyway,
nice,
I'm an idiot. But as we are having fun here on the show, Sam, it might be fun to share a couple emails real quick from people who... Actually, you know what? Before we do that, poll question. We do have to mention... We mentioned it on the Wednesday public radio version of the show that our current poll question is about Snakes on a Plane.
Right.
We're asking you, is it the best motion picture ever made, as Samuel L. Jackson tells us? And the choices are, again, Sam?
And the choices are, yes. Samuel L. does not lie. Snakes on a Plane is more like Passenger 57. I Want My Mother Effin' Money Back, or Might Watch on DVD.
Okay.
And again, I want to say, don't bother watching on a DVD, really. I don't
think. Yeah, that would ruin it.
Unless you're at your dorm and you've got the whole floor
right.
watching it, it's not going to be the same experience.
No, it's
certainly.
Not. But I did want to have an option in there for people that are like, there's no way I'm going to see snakes on a plane. I don't care about the hype. I know there are going to be some of our listeners that feel that way. So
these pheromones are going to make these snakes go crazy.
Crazy, yeah. Okay, well, we'll see. We should update real quick, too, just because it actually is interesting and it will transition nicely into some listener feedback here coming up. Our last week's poll question was, is World Trade Center better than United 93? And I have to say, I'm not shocked, but I'm a little surprised at how it came out. The number one answer, 55% of you said, I'm not going to watch either movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is actually going to come up directly in our feedback about World Trade Center. I'm surprised by it. I mean, I know some people think it's too soon and they don't want to relive 9/11, but to say I'm not going to see either of those movies, I can't believe there's that strong of a feeling about it, really, at this point, that no one wants to watch. It's an Oliver Stone film with Nicolas Cage. No one wants to watch Paul Greengrass. I know he's not a household name, but to our listeners, they should certainly know him,
right.
And they're not interested in seeing what he does with it. And again, the fact that they're two such different films, I can't believe 55% aren't going to watch either film.
Yeah, I'm surprised too. But then again, I mean, like we said, those films do ask you to relive those events. I mean, yes, Oliver Stone is about, his film is about survival in some way, and you get the satisfaction of people surviving a great tragedy, but you also have to, you know, sit through something that really was deeply psychologically scarring to so many people, obviously.
Yeah, well, I was happy to see 22% agreed with us and said, no, World Trade Center is not better than United 93. 18%, I won't watch both. So they obviously will watch one of the two films.
Right.
And finally, just 5% said, yes, World Trade Center actually is better than United 93. Again, we have a poll question every week on the website. Go and make your voice heard. And before we get to the World Trade Center feedback, we had a little bit of name feedback we thought that was worth sharing, including
the name change,
as we
the
had there,
change.
Dave Caldwell, we really have to thank for writing in and saying, Van Halgren, fantastic, enough said, which was great. And also this one from Sander was fantastic, Sandy Weiss.
Yeah, Sandy Weiss wrote, so now you've gone through two name changes, Cinecast to Film Spotting, and Sam Halgren to Sam Van Halgren. Your listeners will be able to adjust, but in the interest of avoiding future controversy, why not go whole hog and merge both of your identities into one single mega host? You already sound alike. This is the next logical step. I propose Film Spotting with your host, Saddam Van Halgrenar.
It's coming
sounds
next
like
week.
Sounds like a superhero villain. Villain.
Saddam Van Halgrenar.
Also, a reference to the outtake. And again, if people aren't aware of this, you know.
We've been putting him at the end of the
there's
show.
There's an outtake at the end of every show, and this one is
that last one
priceless.
Took the cake. Sandy says, please play the outtake from the end of episode number 119 at the beginning of every show. So good. And Will Sparks in Charlottesville, Virginia.
You maybe want to note, too. I mean, just like when you're listening to it, it really was. We went right from that outtake to just doing the show.
To doing the show. And I almost included that whole thing just to kind of prove that, because it does add a little extra layer of humor.
Bring it.
But yeah, Will Sparks was another person who mentioned how good the outtake was. And really, it's our longest one and probably the funniest one. And it is. It's totally legitimate. That was the beginning of the show.
Right.
Sam screwed up Wilder Embry's name. That gave me an opportunity.
Right.
To actually ask him, was he really going to drop the bombshell at the beginning of the show? But then Sam says, bring it, which is the last thing you hear.
And
there's like 5 seconds of pause, and then it's from Chicago. This is and it really was
we're
a lot of fun.
We're professionals at the end of the day, yeah.
Okay, well, World Trade Center feedback, Sam. This one from Manuk.
Yeah, Manuk. Regarding Oliver Stone's World Trade Center, he has a theory, actually, because, I mean, yes, a lot of critics are commenting on how un-Oliver Stone the film is, a simple story with no controversy, no politics, etc. And the theory, Manuk's theory, is that this is the first of Oliver Stone's 9/11 movies, just like his Vietnam saga when he explored the war from three different perspectives, Platoon, Born on the 4th of July, and Heaven and Earth. This, Manuk suggests, is the safe one, honoring the heroic rescue workers, which no one would have an objection with. But then Manuk believes that he'll go back to being Oliver Stone in a few years and make his JFK version of 9/11, where he'll dig really deep and ultimately accuse our own government for the events of that day. Actually, I came up with this prediction a couple of years after 9/11 when I started hearing conspiracy theories. I thought those theories would make a great Oliver Stone film. So in conclusion, I think he made this film so later he won't be accused of being un-American for his controversial version. He will always have this film to argue for his patriotism. This might seem ridiculous and unfounded, but he's the kind of director who's attracted to controversial stories, and that's what he's best at. What do you think?
I love it. I love the suggestion. I really love
the theory.
I
mean, it's a theory, and right now we should make clear it is an absolute theory.
Yeah, and I think it's totally out there, but I love the idea, the cynicism of that, that really he made this heroic film. He looked all these victims and their families, you know, the victims' families in their eyes and said, I'm glorifying
tell
these
your
people.
Story.
Yeah. And then down the road, he's gonna crap all over them.
He's going to say the Bush administration,
I kind of like it. And there's a part of me that hopes it happens.
Yeah, I got a little buzz of excitement.
We'll see,
idea.
Just because then that's the Oliver Stone we're used to. So this one from Jenny, Fortress of Solipsism in New York City. And Jenny writes in about she saw a segment on MTV where Nicolas Cage and Michael Pena and Oliver Stone were talking to people. And she doesn't think that Nicolas Cage really has the right empathy as a person.
Right.
Based on this, to play this kind of character and to be in this kind of movie. And
so she's not going to see the film.
She's not
going to
go see the film. This is what Jenny says. The first question to them was by a native New Yorker who, and I'm paraphrasing, said, I feel that this movie was made too soon. I feel like the wounds inside me have had salt spilled on them and they are burning hot. Why, Mr. Stone, did you feel you had to make this film? Stone gave a very good, respectable answer. However, Mr. Cage felt he had the right to say something along the lines of, I don't understand why anyone would feel that way. This is a positive film. It ends on a positive note. You didn't have to come see this movie today, and anyone can choose not to see this film. But if you do see it, I hope you'll leave with a good message. Of course, Cage has the right to his own opinion, but I believe that if he's going to be that condescending to someone who had to live through that ordeal and then watch it being dramatized, he does not have the right to act in this film. I was a huge Nick Cage fan, so this was extremely disappointing to me, and not only will I not see World Trade Center, but I won't see any more Nicolas Cage films.
Wow.
Just thought you two would find that interesting. Thanks for a great show. Jenny, I'm sorry. I think you've gone a little too far here, not only because Nicolas Cage deserves to be seen because we love him and think he's a good actor and in this film, but he said a similar thing actually on Charlie Rose when I saw him before the movie was released. And I'm sorry, I agree with him. I'm not saying that if someone thinks it's too soon that they need to see it or that they're wrong for feeling that way, but he's right that if people are out there who don't think it's too soon, who want to tell the story and want the story told, want to see it told, and can somehow feel healed by it, why is that not as worthy as the people who don't want to sit through it? And it is a fact that you don't have to go see the movie. I think he's right on target. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't think that, you know, you should feel like Nicolas Cage is a bad guy for saying that personally.
But then again, I mean, we didn't see the show she was referring to, and it's possible that he came across as more abrasive than, who knows? But, it's surprising that he would even come across as that, you know, unempathetic, knowing how sensitive the subject matter is, knowing where they were recording that. And it's almost like you'd have to, you know, if you're an actor talking about 9/11 at all, you must get like from your PR person. It's just like, here, we need to be very careful about how we respond to these things. But I think you're right, and I agree with you. But it's possible that, you know, he showed a little bit of
insensitivity. He could have come off a little smug, and on the page it maybe comes off that way. But I saw him say that really, that exact line on Charlie Rose, and it didn't seem condescending to me.
Right.
So,
all right, well, here's an email from Bob, who actually has seen the film, as opposed to the previous two emails, and he writes to say, I hate to say I was disappointed in this film, which is an awful lot like watching a high-end Lifetime Network TV movie. At United 93, I teared up several times and left the theater very, very angry. I never got that emotionally involved in World Trade Center, and although it's photographed very realistically, and the scene where the cops are volunteering to go into the building has an emotional impact, I never even cried at this movie, and that means something coming from an emotional wreck like myself. And that's Bob. And I guess we're in the middle ground, but he's also, sort of reflecting what we said too. I mean, we found that there were several moments, really, I think, that were emotionally impactful, but it did not have the same feeling at the end of United 93, where you almost can't get out of your chair and like the impact of what happened. You are reliving sort of the impact at the end of United 93
here. It's much more dramatic, intense, and again, we're kind of what I was saying in the middle ground, because we agree with him that it's not as well made or important or charged a film as United 93 is, but we did have moments where we teared up a little bit watching certain parts of the film. So
just like we would at any Lifetime TV movie.
Exactly. Right. I watch them all the time, Sam. We also have some really interesting feedback on our top five true stories. We want to get to a few of them here, including this one from our friend Magnus from Berlin. He says, guys, and in this case especially Sam, you just helped me to figure out the mystery why everybody seems to regard The Insider as such a great film, and it does nothing for me at all. It has nothing to do with smoking or such. It is that, as a European, I haven't been brought up believing in 60 Minutes always being honest and fair. I did know of them before watching the movie, but hadn't actually seen a single show. So for me, they just acted like I would expect media people to. and thus the movie does not have a climax for me. It's just what you have seen before, people getting used and then dropped by the media.
It's so interesting. So interesting. And it's that kind of global context that we would never have with a film like this. I mean, we're born into the idea that 60 Minutes was this symbol of journalistic integrity. And the movie, without maybe building up that, really, I mean, it doesn't tell you that. I think it relies on the fact that you know that. And it's really interesting to hear somebody that would not have grown up that way.
Yeah, and I think maybe he's onto something. Yeah, he really is.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
Well, really, we have some other great top five true stories lists we're going to get to here in the next segment. But if you've got feedback for us, send us an email or short MP3 clip to feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-CINNA, 206-203-2463. We'd love to hear from you.
When we come back, Old School, The College Years. Adam and I review the new comedy, Accepted. Back in a moment.
In the wealthy seaside community of Neptune, the rich and powerful make the rules. They own the town and the high school and desperately try to keep all their dirty little secrets hidden. Unfortunately for them, there's Veronica Mars. By day, Veronica is another senior at Neptune High School, but at night she helps with her father's private investigator business, solving the town's toughest mysteries. Discover Veronica Mars, Season 2, now on DVD.
Good evening, listeners, and all ships at sea, from the road of Bombay to the Caspian Sea, and the world service of the BBC. Tuning in a shortwave and ship to shore. Drink a dram for the king of rock and roll, John Peel. John Peel. I went to his farm just for a spell. Came in on the arm of Laura Cantrell. Had every record ever sent him, even the ones he never played. He said there's a life there living in the grooves, and I can feel him when I'm walking in the room. John Peel. John Peel.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and we are going to talk about the movie Accepted, which is another film. Like Nacho Libre, you were misguidedly conducting the hype train.
I know.
You and our guest host, Scott Smith.
This just shows my enthusiasm for movies. I mean, these people that challenge the idea that we like comedies, like to laugh. Here I am championing two movies that we'll see about Accepted, but Nacho Libre didn't live up to expectations,
no.
But I wanted it to.
You did. And now, here with Accepted, you were really pushing hard for it, and we decided to go see it. So, yes, we addressed this in the dope sheet also earlier in the week, but if anyone is confused at all with our schedule, we were going to review The Illusionist.
That's right.
And we have decided to push that back. It's only on like 40 screens right now, and even though you've already seen it,
yes.
And we're both excited to see it and talk about it, we are going to push that back a little bit. We decided to do Little Miss Sunshine first, and then this week talk about Accepted. So, anyway, a little bit of scheduling changes there, but we'll get back on track. And we are going to talk about Accepted, but before we do that, we wanted to just wrap up the top five true stories list. Got some great feedback, including this one from Jeffrey Rosado in Huntsville, Alabama. His number one, Catch Me If You Can, a film I really do like of Steven Spielberg's. He says it's Spielberg's most underrated movie and one of his most entertaining. He also has Apollo 13. When you can reduce a theater of moviegoers to tears, even when they know the outcome, you've done your job. My favorite Ron Howard film. It's not my favorite Ron Howard film.
No, but it's probably among...
But it's good.
It's good. I put it up there with a Cinderella Man that's like, you know, it's not as sentimental as we come to expect Ron
probably.
Howard to be.
And
I, really good
fine.
Performances.
Like,
it's really fun.
I have to say, I didn't consider it anywhere close for my top
no,
five. I don't love it that much.
But it definitely came up.
And he's right. It's another case where you are moved when the shuttle appears at the end, or the rocket, the capsule appears at the end. You're like, oh, they survived. Yeah. Even though you already know they do.
And
it,
I still think of
works.
The scene where they dump a bunch of supplies. It's like, here's what we can find on the ship.
Out.
We got to figure it out. That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah. Okay. Also, number three, It Could Happen to You. This is the Nicolas Cage, Bridget Fonda movie. If Frank Capra were still around, he'd be making sweet movies like this, where the loosely based on the true story where the cop gives a waitress $2 million tip. Number
I think
four,
that was the original title, interestingly.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Right. October Sky. Okay, call me biased, but since I live in one of the towns that played a major role in the space program, I can't help but beam with pride at Homer Hickam's coming-of-age story. It is a good movie, I think, with a nice performance from Chris Cooper and Jake Gyllenhaal. And number five, one I really had a problem leaving off, To Die For. Another loosely based on gem.
Loosely.
It is, but Kidman is brilliant, and how about a little love for Joaquin Phoenix? I knew he was destined for greatness even back then. All this and a David Cronenberg cameo, too, and it is true. He appears at the end. It's great.
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, it is, and based on an incident that took place in my home state of New Hampshire, Pamela Smart case. Yeah, I mean, totally fascinating story, but obviously turned into a kind of media satire as well by... Van Zant.
Yes.
Nice pick. All right. This one from Alex. His top five true stories: Black Hawk Down, The Perfect Storm, United 93, Hotel Rwanda, and Anchorman.
Of course.
Of course. Alex wants to make a quick argument for Anchorman. This is more a love letter to the 70s and the golden age of local news when the newsman was king and there were no CNNs or Fox News channels. Also, the whole cast is awesome and there are no unfunny moments that I can think of. Think on it. And
okay,
I should note that this last week's Dope Sheet, those of you that subscribe to the Dope Sheet will get Anchorman versus Blazing Saddles. My treatise on comedy. Why Anchorman is better than Blazing Saddles. That's right. If you haven't subscribed to the Dope Sheet, do it now.
Now you have to. And actually, if you want to find a link, obviously you won't get Sam's old Dope Sheet from this week where he did that, but you will
find
the link.
The ideas will still be fresh.
They will be fresh. You'll find the link to that archived email on our Dope Sheet page. Go to filmspotting.net. And Alex Thompson, nice try. That's more egregious than me putting, you know, Twin Peaks
or
in a
putting
movies
the bag,
list.
Or, yeah, the Big Red One,
the Big
perhaps,
Red One,
on
perhaps. Yeah, yeah, but right. It was a nice try, and we give you, you know, credit for the effort. Last one here from John Johnston. Number five, Heavenly Creatures. I really can't believe how much I like this movie. Sam, you had it on yours.
Six through ten, yeah.
Number four, River's Edge. Watch a larval Keanu Reeves completely inhabiting the role of an emotionally retarded burnout. No way. Number three, Midnight Express. Apparently, the real-life Billy Hayes had disavowed the film as too fictional, which I just don't understand. It is a great choice. Number two, Dog Day Afternoon. This should totally be in the penalty box. He's right,
it was.
And it was our Massacre Theater choice.
Right.
And number one, The Killing Fields. I have nothing cute to add here. And, you know, I Cinecast Film Spotting Confession, I haven't seen The Killing Fields with Sam Waterston, but I would like to watch it in conjunction with Salvador,
I was going to say, absolutely.
James Woods in that movie, it comes out
Sam Waterston,
a couple years later, he keeps ripping on Sidney Shamberg.
That's right.
For being,
and that's,
you know, that he wasn't really
Waterston.
The last guy out of Cambodia, which James Woods is claiming he was, his character, Richard Boyle.
That's great.
He's talking about that whole story of them being in Cambodia that you see in The Killing Field. So anyway, great list there. We thank everyone for their feedback. But Sam, it is accepted time.
Relax, we're all going to college, okay?
This is said by the guy who's been rejected by seven schools.
All Bartleby Gaines ever wanted was to be accepted.
I can't believe I didn't get into state.
All he ever got...
I'm having a party at my house, and I was wondering if you'd like to...
I'd love to.
Mow our lawn.
...was rejected.
Hey, I hate my life. Have fun being hot.
So after every college turned him down...
You want to have a happy and successful life? You go to college.
...his only option... was to make one up.
South Harmon Institute of Technology. This is the act of a desperate, wildly unrealistic person.
Your son is going to college.
Just one click away from acceptance.
That's right. That's right. Where was that when we were applying to school, Sam?
Right.
This movie accepted again. You've been pushing it. We decided why not.
Plus, I pushed it once.
We got some emails from other people, including, I think I mentioned Kyla in Canada,
Kyla
who said,
in Canada.
Funniest movie I've seen all year. And we said, you know what? Kyla sounds like a smart girl.
Yes, she
We're
going
to go ahead
She's
and take
Canada.
That.
She's from Canada. Smart up there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're going to run with it.
And
we
Scott Smith,
saw it,
too.
And Scott Smith, our guest host, was also pushing for it. So we decided to see it and talk about it. And it was kind of, we thought, you know what, let's just do kind of a comedy show. Yeah. We did get that
Lady
email
Eve
from Stuart, 200 rubles, saying, you guys just aren't into comedy enough. We said, we're going to go see Accepted. I guess we'll see how into comedy we are. And my setup question for you about this film, Sam, of course, it should be just, did you laugh a lot? But my question for you is, this is a film that has many nice little direct homages to films like The Breakfast Club and also especially Can't Buy Me Love, kind of an underrated, overlooked classic with
Patrick Dempsey
from the early, mid-80s. And it also, though, has the feel, of course, of the modern films, the old schools.
The old school template
is in
full
effect. Old school template is definitely there. So I'm wondering, did the film mix those two together good enough for you to enjoy it? And does it really belong in the same conversation as any of those films?
personally, I mean, no, for me, it doesn't. And largely because it didn't make ultimately make me laugh all that often. But you're right, it does. It mixes this, you know, the 80s Revenge of the Nerds really scenario with old school. And I think really it's funny. And I think we've been thinking, I've particularly been thinking so much about comedy recently, particularly with the Screwball Comedy Marathon and just this criticism we're getting for not having a sense of humor, basically.
We should say it was one email.
It was one email. Okay. All right, fine. But we're very sensitive.
Yeah.
It made me realize, really, for me, what old school does so well, and where this movie kind of fails. And I have a few problems with it. But to get to that idea, I mean, certainly, I mean, look at this. I mean, old school, you know, a bunch of 30-year-old guys putting together a fraternity, which is an absurd premise and a funny premise. And then you've got these, you know, high school seniors making their own university, okay? I mean, it's just not a far stretch at all. But I think why old school works, and partly why, except it didn't quite work for me, is that you have, in old school, they create a world, an absurd world, where you never question any of the logic of the characters. You just sort of accept it and you run with it. And with accept it, and again, I'm not going into these films wanting to criticize it, but with its target, you know, instead of putting together a fraternity, which is a very small, funny, and even kind of sad notion about 30-year-old guys doing that, you run into some serious logistical problems when you're an 18-year-old kid founding a university. And they never quite go far enough in terms of solving the logistical problems. Or like the people they have involved in putting this thing together, you just don't quite, for me, the question about how these people are doing this or why is never quite answered. First of all, you got Justin Long, who I really like. I think he's a very charismatic guy, very funny in The Breakup, I thought. And he's our Vince Vaughn in this one.
Yeah.
And the fact is, this kid's so charming and funny and, you know, quick on his feet. There's no way he gets rejected to 8 schools.
That's true.
That's not a big problem. But then you've got another girl who's, you know, like the first time you meet her, she's whining about not getting into Yale.
Rory.
Rory, since second grade, all she wanted to do was get into Yale. And the reason she's not going to college is because she only applied to Yale and didn't get in. And I'm sorry, again, I don't want to sound like I'm taking this stuff too seriously.
But you are.
But I am. And there are just little problems with that where, where the world they create isn't quite so different from our existing world where the rules apply.
Okay. Anyway. I see what you're saying, but you're wrong. No, I do feel, though, that you maybe are just nitpicking a little bit. I mean, yes, you're right. It's totally unbelievable.
But again, I can only say that because ultimately I wasn't laughing quite enough.
I understood. I give you that. That's surely where you're coming from. But I was thinking about a movie like Caddyshack or some of these movies where characters in it are totally not believable, right? You really don't expect to see characters do things like Chevy Chase does as Ty Webb, or like Bill Murray's character does.
But I think
they
create their own worlds in some way where that kind of stuff can happen.
But more importantly, you just have to accept that even if they're not representative of actual people, they're representative of types we all know and recognize. And I think that's the case here. Do you ever accept that a girl who is smart enough to even consider that she should have gotten into Yale doesn't have any college plans?
Right.
No, you can't. But you know that type of person, the type of person who works so hard, didn't get what she thinks she deserves, and now she's just kind of burned out. You get that. You understand the type of character like Justin Long, who is quick on his
feet. I just wanted them to use a little more imagination and give me a reason otherwise for why she'd do that. That's all. I just think it's a little lazy.
No, it's a little lazy, but then again, I don't think they had any choice with the premise. They had to be a little bit lazy with it. No, really, because there's no way to explain what they're doing. Explain setting up a university. And so if you really get into tearing apart the plot, it's not going to work. And I'm not saying, I didn't laugh probably as much as it sounds like Kyla in Canada did. I don't think it's, you know, the hidden gem of the year or anything by any means. But I have to say, just in terms of laughs, I did laugh a lot more than I thought I would going in. I mean, we talked about it a little bit. You had seen about the first 30 minutes of it when we talked, which we won't explain that story. But and you had mentioned that it wasn't
Snakes on a Plane, you know, is involved.
It wasn't really working for you. And I know that on Metacritic, people have been blasting it. So maybe it was the low expectations. But I went in. And the fact is, I can count at least 10 times I laughed out loud.
Honestly,
and that's
me
enough
too.
For me.
Okay, that's not
enough for me,
guess,
to say.
I bet
I
we were laughing
people,
at the same stuff.
We probably are. I mean, we've already joked about some of them, but Sherman Schrader, his best friend. Do you have his name there somewhere,
Yeah,
Sam?
Jonah Hill.
Jonah Hill, his best friend,
the man is a comic genius.
Every line.
Impeccable delivery.
Every line out of his mouth.
I wish we could say some of them.
I wish we could say some of them. I mean, they are all gold. And really, he just cracked me up. Even moments that I knew were coming from the trailer, they made me laugh watching him in the film and the way he delivered them in their context. And so I enjoyed all those moments. And you mentioned something to me on the phone. I don't think you quite said it this way during talking about Snakes on a Plane. But you mentioned just at some point in that film, and maybe it was later when Sam Jackson finally says his line.
Right.
But you realized you were having fun with the film. And I never had that moment. But with Accepted, there's a point in that film, and I think it's exactly when we were joking about it off air, the scene where he wants to get into this fraternity, Jonah Hill, Sherman Schrader. He wants to get into this fraternity so bad that they're just humiliating him, and he really doesn't belong there. And they say, okay, are you ready to be part of this place? And he starts saying some lines about, yes, I want hair gel just like yours.
I want to wear the visor at an angle and the hair gel.
Yeah, and I want to sleep with women like her. It's so funny that I went, you know what? I'm having a good time with this film. I really, and the other moment was the party they have. Yeah. They throw a party at their school that's just everyone's rocking out and having a great time. You see it in the preview where they pull the fire, the bad guy on his way out pulls the fire alarm and it starts raining. And then instead of saying, oh crap, the party's ruined, they just keep partying. I said, you know what? I'm having a good time.
Isn't that hooked up to the fire department of the local city?
Thank you, Sam. I knew that was coming.
I'm just kidding.
I knew that was coming.
I'm just kidding. And honestly, I think that's a really interesting point that I bet we laughed at the same stuff. And for me, I never turned a corner on really enjoying myself. I just was laughing at isolated moments.
You wouldn't say to someone who said, hey, I'm thinking about going to see Accepted, you wouldn't say to them, you know what, you should. It's got enough funny moments in it to make it worthwhile.
I would say if you're in a hotel room alone in a city and it's playing on HBO, don't change the channel.
Are you ironing your clothes?
This is the Harold and Kumar syndrome. Yes. This is a perfect Harold and Kumar kind of movie. Catch it by chance and enjoy
it. It's a Super 8 movie.
Certainly enjoy Sherman Schrader. And Justin Long has some great lines, too.
No, he's funny, too. He's charming. And on Ed, the TV show Ed, I always liked him there, too.
This is my other problem. And again, I don't know, is there music cued for me taking everything too seriously?
Yeah, no kidding.
But I think the movie does set up a problem here in that the villain, and I think it because the way the plot is set up requires there to be a villain, losers versus winners. The winners, the bullies, is organized education. It is higher education.
So?
It implies, and I don't think, it's not really, I don't think that there's not a lot of conviction with which they, criticize.
They're not really taking on necessarily.
But instead of taking on like a single institution, honestly, there is a sense at the end that they're saying like they're criticizing higher education for like breaking people's dreams. Like that's what higher education does. And I think it is a kind of irresponsible and silly message. I'm not saying that kids will take this as some message that they shouldn't go to college or it's bad or unnecessary. I'm just saying like, I just wonder if they meant to take that kind of, that kind of criticism or the plot sort of
forced
them to.
They're not at all implying that higher education is actually a bad thing. They're actually saying just the opposite. They're saying it's a great thing, that you should strive for it and you should strive for learning. They're questioning the system, but they're not even questioning the system because then it becomes a social, kind of political statement, which they're not making.
It's a lame one, but they do make it.
No, what they're making ultimately is the argument for something I alluded to when we talked about Snakes on a Plane, that argument of just individuality. It's just kind of your classic 80s movie where it's about individuality and not conforming and being able to explore your own personal dream. That's what the movie's about. And you know what? It kind of works.
It doesn't really work.
For me, it did. At the end, you get this Footloose moment, and Revenge of the Nerds moment where he gives his speech. It's totally ridiculous, but it kind of works for me. And the touches to other films that I did love growing up. The Breakfast Club, of course, his sister wants a fake ID. She's like 7. She wants a fake ID so she can vote.
She can vote.
Got to be a reference to Anthony Michael Hall in
The Breakfast Club. But it's also, the little sister, I'm glad you brought it up, because it bothered me because, stolen whole cloth from Bottle Rocket in a way, too. I mean, that character that you don't know why he's confiding in her. She's a little brat, and we have an early scene.
He had
scene.
No choice.
Yes, he did. He didn't have to tell her anything. And she's a little brat. He has no relationship with her, as opposed to Grace, the wonderful Grace in Bottle Rocket, where it's like, when did Grace get so cynical all of a sudden? There's a sense that he has a relationship with Grace, Luke Wilson, in Bottle Rocket. In this, they've taken the character, but no love. It just doesn't work.
Oh, okay. Well,
but it is funny. I'm not going to say it didn't make me
sure,
laugh.
Sure, Sam, you try to salvage it at the end.
I
by
have
saying
higher
it.
Expectations for my comedy.
I guess. And again, I'm not saying that it's the most perfect film. It's the funniest film of the year. It's not funnier than Talladega Nights.
Not funnier
it's
than
not,
Clerks 2.
It's not even funnier. Yeah, not funnier than Clerks 2. It may not even be funnier than Lady in the Water.
Not funnier than The Breakup. Or Lady in the Water. Which, or Snakes
sorry,
on a Plane.
I just
you heard
had,
it.
I just had to get in a jab at Shyamalan. But actually, there were enough laughs in it that when I walked out, I felt like I could say to someone, you know what, go to just kind of hear some of Sherman Schrader's lines. I think those enough
and
make it
worth
I'd
it. Say...
And it, I liked overall, Sam, I just have to say, I liked the sensibility of it. I liked the rebelliousness
you
of it.
You love that.
I do. I respected the anti-authority kind of string throughout the film. And again, it made me walk out and realize that whole rant I went on about Snakes on a Plane, it made me realize that because they at least had the right idea about not conforming and being individuals, and it worked.
It's lame. And I will say, if you walk out of World Trade Center, you're feeling a little down, and you don't want to pay for another movie, I know Adam doesn't approve of this.
No, I don't.
But you walk right into Accepted. Go ahead. It's the multiplex. Have fun. You'll have a few laughs, but that's the context you need to see this movie.
Basically, you should disregard everything Sam has said.
I am telling you. Here, look, listen
minutes.
To me. Anti-authority. You should be eating this up.
I suppose so. All right. Well, if you've seen Accepted and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please send any feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. Check out our top five archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more at filmspotting.net. And please help us reach new listeners by voting for us at podcastalley.com. A direct link is available on our blog under Vote for Film Spotting. Also on our blog, sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting Weekly email blast.
Opening in wide release this weekend, Invincible with Mark Wahlberg and Greg Kinnear, the new Broken Lizard comedy Beer Fest, How to Eat Fried Worms, and in limited release, the new Prohibition-era musical Idlewild, featuring Terrence Howard and members of Outkast. Next week, we'll have a review of Invincible, and we'll have a running diary of when and how often we cried during that film.
Yes.
Plus, the final film in our Screwball Comedies Marathon, Adam's Rib, and the top five movies that make us cry. Thanks to Paul Birch and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Check him out on the web at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Bobby O'Shea. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Sign up for a free PeerFlix account now and you'll be entered to win Noah Baumbach's debut, Kicking and Screaming, out this week in a Criterion Collection edition. Learn more at peerflix.com/filmspotting or at filmspotting.net. Film Spotting magic here. We're just making magic.
I piss magic.
I piss excellence here. That's what we do on Film Spotting,
Sam. All we do
Sam.
Is piss excellence.
Okay.